This is Mame Warren. Today is the 15th of December, 1996. I'm in Williamsburg, Virginia with Park Rouse. And I'm just real pleased to be here because yours is a name that has come up a whole lot in the last year while I've been doing these interviews. One of the things you mentioned in your talk is that you arrived by train, but you didn't say where you came from.
I boarded the CNO train in Newport News in the morning. My father put me on, I think, about 8:30 or 9. And we went on up to Stanton, where I got off the CNO, and then I boarded a little train that used to run, I think, under auspices of the Baltimore, Ohio. It was called the Virginia Creeper, and it only went from Stanton, I think, to Lexington. And when we got off at the station, I remember there were three or four guys from the Viscount Sig House who were down there to meet the train to rush. We, in those days, we had fraternity rushing immediately. And the train was a little tunable trolley thing, a very simple, rustic. It folded soon after I came up there. There was an engine and then a train that was divided, part of it with, I think, had coal to feed the engine, and then another part of it was the postal car that it seemed to carry the mail. And then I think there was one other car that was half freight and half passengers. The passenger part was up front, and it was very austere and simple. And I realized that we were back almost a century earlier, and wouldn't have anything like that down here in Tidewater. But that was the train, and the station was torn down, I believe, to make way for the Lenfest Center.
Well, the station's actually still there.
Is the station still there?
It's right next to the Lenfest Center.
One of the stories I heard later at the station was that Mr. Greenlee Letcher, who was the son of, or grandson of governor, of the Civil War governor, John Letcher. Mr. Greenlee Letcher was a lawyer in Lexington, and who'd gone to VMI with my uncle, Mr. William E. Barrett in Newport News, and who was very kind to me. Mr. Letcher had a law office downtown, but it was small, and whenever he got a year's files of his correspondence, he'd put them in a what we call a nail keg and tap on the top and write on it with a big heavy pencil. Greenlee D. Letcher files 1935-36, and take them down and store them in the old railroad station. And I think that was true. Other people used this railroad station for storage those after it closed.
I didn't know that. That's new.
Yep.
Oh, that's new information. So you're arriving at Washington and Lee during the Depression.
Right.
What was Washington and Lee like at that point?
Well, the university itself seemed very beautiful and well kept. Most of Lexington was pretty rustic then. There was a McCoy's grocery there at an intersection quite close to the university. I thought it was very colorful. They used to have chinkapins, which were little chestnuts that people got in the fall. I loved chinkapins, but I hadn't seen many of them except in Lexington. And right next door, quite maybe two doors away from the McCoy's grocery, which was a locally owned grocery store, was the Dutch Inn, which a Mrs. Owens ran. I think Ms. Owens was connected with I think her mother was a Mrs. Christian, old Lexington family. And that was a very nice small inn with very good food. It was famous for its food. only could handle small dinners for maybe 18 or 20 people, plus it's normal dining room. But the rest of Lexington was sort of helter-skelter. Right next door to the Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity, which I joined, was a tombstone cutter's business. Mr. Remsburg, R-E-M-S-B-U-R-G, I believe, he would cut tombstones and exhibit them there in the yard. All of that lower section of Main Street, which is now sort of boutiques, was either closed or occupied by small local businesses, and that part of the Main Street seemed mostly devoted to black business. They hadn't restored any of those old houses that are now pleasant little B&Bs further up Main, and they hadn't reclaimed a couple of them that are now restaurants. So I'd say it was a very plain town. A VMI alumnus named Wise, who wrote a book, I think called The End of an Era, says Lexington was a typical Presbyterian valley town, and he at some point says it was as cold as a dog's nose. I didn't feel that it was necessarily cold. I thought it was an interesting collection of architecture, very unlike what we had down here in Tidewater, and yet very attractive in its way, the combination. And that still exists. Some of it looks like Germanic stuff from Gettysburg further up the valley, and some of it looks more like Scotch-Irish. But it was a hodgepodge of everything. An awful lot of people on the street that looked like they'd just come in from House Mountain. We always thought of House Mountain as being an area where a lot of derelicts lived. I'm not sure that was true, but it was said that in those mountains around Lexington were the descendants of Hessian soldiers who had abandoned the Hessian army during the Revolution, had taken up farmsteads in the mountains, and they were the people who made bootleg whiskey, so the story went. So I would see a lot of those on the street on Saturdays. Marshall Peenick, who was the daughter of the treasurer, Dr. Paul Peenick, P-E-N-I-C-K, she would go out to House Mountain every Sunday while I was in college and teach a Sunday school class. And a lot of people seemed to be involved in Presbyterian good works in the rural parts of Rockbridge County.
Wow, I'm glad you mentioned the Dutch Inn, because I just recently found a picture of the interior of the Dutch Inn.
Mm-hmm.
And today it just has some shops in it, but I never really had a picture of it, an idea of what it was like inside. So was it one of the fancier restaurants in town?
Yeah, the Dutch Inn was one of the nicer places to dine. There was further up the street, there was the Southern Inn, I believe, and there were one or two other places. The nicest place was Forest Tavern over near Natural Bridge, or you could go to the Natural Bridge Hotel. There weren't too many stylish restaurants, though, in Lexington. Most of them were aimed for the college trade, the boys that didn't belong to fraternities or didn't eat at the college dining hall.
Mm-hmm. But most people belong to fraternities?
My guess is that when I was there, that Washington and Lee in the period 34 to 37, it seems to me it had something like 1,300 students, of whom I think roughly 1,000 would have been undergraduates and 300 would be law students. And my impression is about 70% of the undergraduates belonged to fraternities. And fraternities in those days, there were either 19 or 20, maybe the figure varied while I was there, but though they fed an awful lot of boys, and there were a couple of nice boarding houses around the campus where you could get pretty good meals, but there were not many restaurants.
So tell me about fraternity life.
The fraternities were very strong, and they had fairly, I think the rules governing them were fairly liberal. As I said, when I arrived, a bunch of fraternity men were at the train station, either to meet me or someone else who apparently didn't come. But the fraternities were highly competitive. I got the impression there were really more fraternities than the situation warranted, and some of the fraternities on some years would come up with a very small class. The SAEs were, I think, about the biggest. To me, the most appealing were the three or four that were called Red Square right down in front of the W&L, because they were close at hand. Some of them, like the Phi Kappa Sigs, were way out on Main Street, which was too far to go. The ATOs were fairly far out. The SAEs were fairly far out. The Phi Kappa Psis were fairly far out. But the Betas and the Phi Caps, oh, I've been saying Phi Kappa, it was Kappa Sig that was way out. The Phi Caps were close to the campus. The Sigma Nus and the Pi Kappa Alphas, which I joined, all of those were, and the Phi Delta Thetas, all of those were close to the campus and very desirable. One thing that struck me was how many students had cars. I was a pretty poor guy, and my family never was able to afford a car, and I really didn't want one, but a fair number of students then, I suppose everybody now, had an automobile.
What kind of cars?
Well, most of them in those days, people like roadsters with rumble seats. When you'd go to a girls' school, sometimes you'd take a couple of guys and they'd ride in the rumble seat if there were four guys, two up front and two in the rumble seat. And there was an awful lot of weekend visiting at girls' schools. I think now the girls come over there more, and also they have women students, but you would hear your classmates talking about they were going to Mary Ball on the weekend on Saturday, or going to the Hollins or someplace. And the sad problem was that in those days there were an awful lot of accidents. A fair number of students were killed while I was there. And that was a big worry for the administration, because the roads were winding and a lot of those boys would come home late at night in a hurry and run off the road or have an accident. But the fraternities did have house mothers, which seemed to me a good thing, and I'm real glad they've got it back. Most of the fraternities had little suites on the first floor for the house mother to live in. We had a wonderful lady named Ms. George Otis Mead, whose husband has a relative in town now, Otis Mead, the real estate man. He was not their son, but she was the long time house mother for the Pi Kappa Alphas, and I remember once during Fancy Dress, she told us at breakfast one morning during Fancy Dress, she said, during the night I heard a noise in the phone room, and I went over there and opened the door and said, out came a dead drunk young man, completely naked. Said, I knew it at once he was a University of Virginia student. And all of us burst out laughing because we said, how can you tell whether a guy is a University of Virginia student as opposed to a W&L? She was indignant. Said, well, I knew he wasn't. I knew I'd never seen anybody like that on the campus. And I was sure he was a University of Virginia student. But the house mother seemed to have a good time. They would play cards together. One of the house mothers over at the Sigma Chi house had been an interior decorator, and I was a house manager one year at the Pike A house, and I engaged her for some small sum, like $25 or $50, to help us get decent curtains and rugs and pictures to redecorate the Pike A lower floor. Our house mother, Ms. Mead, used to say that if we ever altered the rules to permit girls to go upstairs, that is to the two upper floors where we had bedrooms, she would leave. And fortunately, we never had that come to pass. The rules did permit girls on the main floor, then on the basement floor where we had the chapter room and a sort of a relaxing room and a bar, but the girls couldn't go above the first floor. And I think that sort of rule existed in all of the fraternities. Every fraternity, as far as I know, had a faculty advisor, and he was supposed to see that the rules of the university were carried out.
How was the food at the fraternity?
Food at most fraternities was said to be pretty good. At our house, we had a elderly black chef named Tibbs, T-I-B-B-S. He had been the main chef at the Hotel Roanoke. Tibbs had been the personal chef for, I think it was President McKinley, and he was present on the railroad car when McKinley was shot. And he had then gone to work for the Hotel Jefferson, the Hotel Roanoke in Roanoke. And when he got too old to work there, one of our members, a guy named Edwards, Dick Edwards, used his influence with the fraternity to get him the job as a chef. He was awfully old and he was forgetful, and once when we had fancy dress, he forgot to prepare a lunch meal. And when the boys all came down the hill hungry after examinations, they found only hog's ears. Tibbs had cooked some hog's ears that he was going to use in a salad with hard-boiled eggs, hog's ears vinaigrette. And we had to serve the hog's ears raw. I don't know what this story's worth, but he served the hog's ears on the plates. And when I came down the hill, I was met by 30 or 40 angry Pikes who said, what did you do this to us for? And I said, what is that? Serve us whole hog's ears. They all had halves growing out of the ears. And I said, well, I don't know, but Tibbs can tell me. And I said, Tibbs, what in the world? He said, Mr. Rose, I got so involved in making tonight's salad that I clean forgot to fix any lunch. So he said, I'll just go out and collect them. And so I went and announced the guys that they're all going to have lunch at McCrum's and give me the bill. I was the house manager. But then that night when I went to bed, there were 50 pounds of hog's ears all jellied and running in my bed. I didn't do anything but take the sheet, which was clean, and the hog's ears carry them down and put them in the refrigerator. And the next day, Tibbs went on and made his vinaigrette salad, which was a big hit that night. And everybody said, "What in the world is this good salad?" And I said, "You'll never know."
That's marvelous. What a great story.
I got called Hogsies by most of the guys who were in the fraternity. From the rest of the day, I still, when I go back, somebody will say, "Pigs in rows."
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, you mentioned fancy dress. Was fancy dress important back in the 30s?
The big thing there in those days was fancy dress. I suspect more important is now. And that was before individual fraternities started having combos play for smaller dances. The fancy dress weekend, which came between the first and second semesters, they only had two semesters in, would be around early February. And you'd ask a date early on in the season, and you had to book a date fairly early in the year to be sure that you got the girl you wanted. And if she went to one of the women's colleges, they arranged for her room, and they would usually, each of the major women's colleges would send a chaperone with the girls from that school, and the chaperone sat on the sidelines at the dance, and the girls from Ranoff-Macon would all have to speak to them, chaperone and Hollins ditto. There was a whole lot of politics going on. Being president of fancy dress was a very desirable honor, and there was a lot of political scurrying around. In those days, we had an alignment of the bigger fraternities called the Big Clique, or Clique, and then the smaller fraternities called the Little Clique, and those contested for offices, and one of the most desirable offices was president of fancy dress, and he got to choose the orchestra, and very often he would have to go up north and talk to the booking people. When I was there, Hal Kemp was a great favorite. Russ Colombo was a favorite. Isham Jones was a favorite. And there was a dance set at finals too, but fancy dress was really the big one because not everybody stayed for finals. So the seniors always, but not the necessarily all the underclassmen.
Were there any themes that were particularly memorable?
Well, they always liked themes that involved beautiful costumes. I think the court of Louis XIV was one that I remember. One of my fraternity brothers named Billy Young hadn't planned to go, but he found a costume in a closet somewhere, and he went. I think he was a cardinal, a French cardinal of the Louis XIV period. But the costumes were all rented by a firm from New York called Hooker and Howe, and Hooker and Howe had a man on the scene at the dance, and when he spied Billy Young dressed as a cardinal, he went down on the dance floor and grabbed him and said, "This costume has been missing for a year." And said, where have you been keeping it?" Poor Billy had to give up his costume. I remember that Dick Byrd, one of the sons of Senator Harry Byrd, was a student in those days. He was younger than I. He was a Pike A. Dick was sort of an unconventional guy, and he had no white shoes, no black dancing shoes or other black shoes to wear with his full dress. So he wore brown shoes that he wore every day. We all thought that was an odd thing that a guy would have gotten that far along in life and not had a pair of black shoes. But it was all very formal. They had a box where the president of the university and guests would sit. One night, Dr. Gaines, the president, had as a guest Mrs. Alfred DuPont, who'd given WNL a lot of money, and also John Stuart Bryan, who was publisher of the Richmond Papers and also then president of William Mary. And the evening wore on, and Mr. Bryan and Ms. DuPont began playing patty cake like you play when you're a little kid. And one of the professors said, "Look, Mr. Bryan is patty caking Ms. DuPont out of all of her money." I said, "Dr. Gaines better get on the ball." Well, we laughed about that, but she continued to be very generous. We used to accuse Dr. Gaines of being awfully close to a lot of widows, and he said, "It's not the widows that interest me, it's the widow's mites." You know the story in the Bible about the widow's mite. And so Dr. Gaines was very popular, as I'm sure the records all show. While I was there, he was invited to be president of Tulane, and the news got out. We put it in the Ring Come Fire. And all of the student body gathered outside the president's house, and the president of the student body got on the porch and urged Dr. Gaines, when he came out, please not to leave WNL. And the trustees felt the same way. And so Dr. Gaines agreed to stay on at WNL. I'm told he was given a considerable bonus by the board for changing his mind and agreeing to stay on.
Tell me about Francis Pendleton Gaines. What do you remember about him?
Well, Dr. Gaines had a wonderful manner, had a marvelous low, throaty voice, and his speeches were very emotional, and he could tell a marvelous story, but he could also get very moved by circumstances. He loved to tell incidents about Lee's presidency, and on Founders Day to talk about George Washington's gift of canal stock, and he'd make it very, very, very moving. He was very much in demand around the country as a speaker, and he was hard put, I think, to keep all of his speaking engagements and university chores. A lot of people, some people complained that he was away too often, but the fact was that while he was there, the endowment greatly increased. He was sort of a pioneer, it seemed to me, in this business of attracting wealthy people to endow the school, and he was especially good, apparently, with widows, with these ladies in the historical societies who'd give money to WNL because it was a historic school. He had a charming wife, and they entertained beautifully. She was from the Deep South, I think, from Louisiana, and her name was pretty Deep Southern, Sadie Duverne, D-U-V-E-R-G-N-E, I believe. And she was a wonderful hostess, and she served marvelous dinners. Incidentally, the student dining hall was, in those days, run by Mrs. Cy Young, Ruth Young. And Ruth Young was also a wonderful cook. The food in the dining hall was really superlative, and I never had any complaints at WNL about the food. The fraternity house I was in had excellent food too, and as a matter of fact, there was not very much need for local restaurants because people were happy to eat where they were supposed to.
It seems to be the case today, too. Now, we've talked about fancy dress. there's another big event that's pretty uniquely Washington and Lee. Did you get involved with the mock convention?
No, I was not much involved with the mock convention. I've never cared very much for politics. And somehow or other, I wasn't really involved in the mock convention, but it was very big in those years. I think we selected Senator Vandenberg of Michigan as a Republican nominee, and I believe he was a Republican nominee, but he didn't win. It was that year, which was my last year at W&L, I think it was a matter of between Taft and Vandenberg, and Vandenberg, as I remember it, was a candidate of the moderate Republicans and Taft of the conservative Republicans. And I think Taft got it, but I think he lost to Franklin D. Roosevelt, as I remember.
But you didn't really get involved.
No one much involved.
In the mock convention. Okay. All right. Now, you know, I think one thing we ought to start talking about a little bit here is academics. That is why we're supposed to go to school, right? I always find it very intriguing when I'm doing interviews. It always takes a long time to get around to the classroom experience. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I guess everybody assumes the academics are going to be good and important. I would normally have gone to the University of Virginia, I guess being a Virginia boy, but I went up to Washington Lee to the Southern Interscholastic Press Association. I was editor of my high school paper, and I liked it a lot. My father had gone to VMI and wanted me to go there, and he'd take me to VMI for a trip, but I knew I wouldn't like VMI. I had no interest in military stuff. And I found out that Washington Lee had a journalism department. As it turned out, after I got to W&L, I decided really to major in English rather than in journalism, but to take some journalism courses. So I ended up with an English major. But I had excellent professors, and the thing I really liked was that at W&L you get the best professors sometimes. Even in your freshman year, I had people like Dr. Shannon, who was chairman of the English department, and Dr. Robert Tucker, who was dean and taught economics. You'd have those in any of the 4 years that you were there. The grading seemed to be fairly severe. The math was always my bete noire. I had Mr. Paxton, and I had a hard time getting through it. One of the arduous courses was Anglo-Saxon under Dr. Shannon. Dr. Shannon had gone to Harvard under a famous Harvard professor who believed that English majors should study not only Anglo-Saxon, but Chaucer and all of the early versions of the English language. So I had to go through all of that, a year of Chaucer, a year of Anglo-Saxon, Shakespeare and all of that. And he was excellent. The faculty had some really popular people. One of them was Lawrence Watkin, who was an English prof, ended up going to Hollywood and writing scripts. He wrote one script, I think, for The Bishop's Wife. He wrote a novel called On Borrowed Time, and that was made into a Broadway hit and later into a movie. And he ended his career, I think, living on the West Coast. Once Larry Watkin had a house on the side of the campus, and he'd sit on his front porch and watch the boys go up and down the campus hill by the Lee Chapel. And he would, my friend Lewis McMurrin, who was a year ahead of me at W&L, lived at Larry's house. So I would go by and often would see would sit on the front porch with Larry and Lewis, and he would say, "Look at that little guy." He said, "That's Charlie McDowell's son, Little Charlie." He said, "Big Charlie was a big football player at center, and he'd love Little Charlie to be one too." But he said, "He's a little skinny kid, see him, big head. But Little Charlie would be bouncing a basketball or dribbling a basketball part of the time. He turned out to be a pretty good basketball player. But even more important, he became a good newspaper man and columnist for the Times-Dispatch. Larry had a great sense of the ridiculous. And one night I came down to his house as he was having a faculty party. And everybody had had a little bit to drink. And he'd say, "Hey, Rose, you remember those limericks you were telling me last night that are going around the dormitories? Come here and tell them to this group." Well, here I was in front of ancient professors of all kinds of subjects, some of whom were my teachers. And these were perfectly awful, pornographic story, limericks that, of the kind college kids are apt to tell. And I had to stand there in front of those guys and tell them these stories. And they guffawed. But I think Larry's enjoyment, which was really pretty cruel, was a fact that it was such an ordeal for me.
Was he a good teacher?
Yeah, Larry was an excellent teacher. He had a wonderful sense of literary style. And he and another English professor named George Foster were both excellent teachers of writing. They helped you to get rid of cliches and try to write with a more in good style and personalized and honest. Tom Riegel was head of the journalism department, and he was an excellent teacher. The best course I think I had at all in WDL was one Tom Riegel taught. The first semester was called literary criticism, and the second half was called critical writing. And he introduced you to all of these modern writers, Hemingway and Dos Passos and all others, and Gertrude Stein. And that was important because although I loved Fitz Flournoy's reading course in the novel, which was an unusual course. We met at Professor Flournoy's house one Thursday night, the Thursday night of each week, and I think the course was limited to about 12 students. And each of us during that week had to read a novel that was an important novel in the history of the novel. And we hadn't, however, come up to modern times, so when I took Larry's course when I took Tom Riegel's course in critical writing and literary criticism, I had to read all these modern things that were good for me and which a lot of people never get around to reading. I later met and interviewed Dos Passos. He said he would only see me if I'd read at least three of his books. Unfortunately, I could tell him I'd read half a dozen.
Well, that was very handy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I bet you got a better interview as a result. That's great.
I was a great admirer of Dr. Robert Tucker, who's the dean of the university. The dean of students was Frank Gillum, who was also a very able man. What struck me so much about WNL then, I don't think it's half as true, unfortunately, was that somebody up there kept up with whatever happened to the alumni. And when my brother was killed in Korea, Frank Gillum wrote a lovely letter and wrote to my mother. And I don't know whether, I'm sure it was some nice lady in somebody's office who just made a point of it, but there was always this sense that somebody at WNL was conscious of the lives of the students that had gone out and would keep in touch when anything important happened in the And particularly Frank Gillum and his wife Louise. Louise and Frank would entertain students all the time. I'd go over to their house for dinner, and when I got married and they invited us to come stay with them in Lexington, the Gaineses were great on having students to dinner, and a number of the other faculty, the Deshays. Very often I think the professor would tend to entertain and know best the students in his department, and that was understandable. But I never sensed that other schools did that as much. One of the things that helped WNL, I think, it was there was no restriction against faculty and students having a drink together. Well, some denominational schools will not permit faculty members to drink with undergraduates, but to me, it was just a normal part of growing up, and it was nice that we were able to meet on common level, and have a little drink and talk and not feel any inhibitions.
I think that would make a difference. There seems to be even today just a wonderful rapport between the faculty and the student body.
There is.
So you've mentioned a lot of names. One name I'm curious to know. Did you know Annie Jo White?
I knew Miss Annie Jo a little bit. She had been active with the Troubadours, the dramatic group, though Larry Watkin had taken it over when I was there. And she showed a great interest in the Troubadours. She'd also, of course, been the librarian. And she was, I think by the time I was there, she was pretty well retired, but she had had a strong influence on the library. In fact, the librarian when I was there was Blanche McCrum, a native Lexingtonian who later went on to Wellesley. Lewis McBurn and I, on a trip to New England once, went by and took Blanche McCrum out to lunch in Boston, and we had a grand reunion. And she then went from Wellesley to the Library of Congress, where she had a very important role. But going back to Miss Annie Jo, there were wonderful stories told about her. She was said to have said, although she never married, she wished she'd had a baby. She said people would have forgotten it by now. She was then 75 years old. And she was quoted as having made a lot of funny quips. She also had once rented a room to John W. Davis, and then later the same room, I believe, to Lewis Powell, both of them very eminent lawyers. And she said it just seemed to her natural to have Lewis Powell as one of her roomers, because that room was dedicated to genius.
That's marvelous. So I need to flip the tape over. Let me do that before I ask the next question.